Okay, so let's get started. So last time we were basically discussing architectures for distributed systems, and I presented a number of them, okay, starting from client-server systems. We looked at peer-to-peer systems. We looked at event-centric architectures. We looked at data-driven architectures. And basically, we stopped here. We were talking really about how proxies fit into the picture. So in a traditional client-server architecture, you have two types of systems, client systems and servers. Servers provide services that clients access. And in edge server systems, you have a intermediary that sits between the client and the server called the proxy. Okay, so you have what is essentially a client proxy server system. Okay, so in this picture, that is your proxy. Okay, that's the client there. This is really the server here. Okay, so what happens is the client does not directly go to the server to access a service. It actually sends its request to the proxy. Okay, and the proxy checks if it has either the data or the necessary resources to service this request. If so, it is going to do it without any intervention from the server. Okay? If not, then the request is forwarded to the server and the server will process the system, process the request. Okay? So the advantage of using a proxy are it reduces the load on the central servers. Some of the requests are offloaded to proxy server, and there need not be just one, there could be many. And clients can go to any proxy, maybe the nearest one, to access the service that the server is providing. Okay. So proxies can offload or take over some of the load or the burden that the server would have faced and reduce the load on the server. It may also improve client performance because the proxy can be deployed closer to clients, and as a result, you do not have to go off to a distant server. Your request can be serviced by close by proxies. Okay. Scenarios where proxies are used are either web caching or for doing streaming over the web. Okay, so if you actually look at any large system that does streaming, you have a collection of proxies that are deployed globally, and they cache content from the servers, and then the content is streamed to you from a nearby server. Okay? We will come back to proxies and their uses in what is called a content distribution network later on in this course, when we look at the World Wide Web and servers and clients and proxies in that context. We'll come back to this issue. Okay. So yet another architecture for a distributed system is what is called a collaborative distributed system. Yeah, and the example of such a system is what you probably know as BitTorrent, which is a collaborative peer-to-peer download system. Okay, in all of these systems, entities collaborate with one another to achieve some task. Okay, in the context of BitTorrent, peers are collaborating to service download requests. Okay. And the picture here shows how BitTorrent works. So essentially there is something called a torrent file which is stored on a web server somewhere. The torrent keeps track of all the peer. Torrent essentially is the index for the file. It keeps track of a tracker, which is a server which has information about which nodes are currently participating in the system and which nodes are either downloading or uploading content. So what you would do is you would get the torrent, then you would look up the tracker for this file. So for each file that you want to download, there's a torrent. You download this torrent from typically a web server, and this has a reference to a tracker. Okay, that's the tracker, and the tracker is a server that has addresses of all the nodes that have content for this file. Okay, so what your client would then do is go to the tracker and find out which nodes are currently available to download content. And then you contact multiple of them, okay, and download chunks of the file. So file is partitioned into chunks. Each node may have one or more chunks. Okay, and then you download chunks in parallel from multiple clients. Okay. So you can get the advantage of higher throughput because you're downloading in parallel. Okay, you can get more bandwidth than if you had gotten, you would have gotten if you had only downloaded this file from a single node. Yes, you get the advantage of parallelism. If some nodes go away, then there are other nodes that take over, so you can still get parallel downloads very quickly. So BitTorrent is used for very large file downloads. Okay? Everything from large video files to large software distributions. So Linux distributions are typically distributed using BitTorrent these days. So you can get a whole DVD or multiple DVDs that you can actually download using BitTorrent. Now again, we will come back to why you should collaborate and what you get by collaborating later on in this course. But the only thing I want to mention here is there is in BitTorrent there's an incentive for collaboration. So you might ask, why should I participate in the system and allow other peers to download from me? Okay? In many peer-to-peer systems, this is a problem. This is called a problem of freeloaders, where peers download content but don't make their content available to others. So you're only getting from others but not participating in the system. In BitTorrent, there's an incentive mechanism that is built in. Okay, it forces altruism, which basically says that if a peer sees that you're uploading, you're downloading more than you're uploading, then other nodes will actually reduce the rate at which they're allowing you to download. So you see slower downloads. You participate in the system and let others download content from you, then other peers will also increase the rate at which they're sending you data. So if you allow others to upload, download from you, then you get faster downloads from others. So that's the incentive mechanism that is built in there. Okay, so you could, even in BitTorrent, not allow others to access your content, but then you get very slow download rates from other clients. Okay, so that's the incentive.
What about users who don't have any chunks of the file yet?
Right. So the question is, what happens if you don't have any chunks of the file yet? So this takes that into account. You have to have some content to share, otherwise there is no point in allowing slow download. So once you have some content, if you're not sharing, then it will start reducing the rate at which you can download. And because these are large file and download takes tens of minutes, hours or days, this will kick in at some point, the incentive mechanism.
What if you pretend you never have any pieces of the file?
Well, since you are actually using a BitTorrent client to download stuff, okay, the other nodes have records of what has been sent to you. So that the tracker will know what you have downloaded, what you have not downloaded. Your client, typically you could write your own client which would have malicious intent of not allowing, I shouldn't say malicious, but doesn't basically take this incentive and let others download. But typically, since you are actually actively downloading, other nodes know what you have gotten from them. So they will know this information. Okay?
Plus, I would just like to point out this thing. That some of the clients, even if you don't want to upload, they would upload like simultaneously. Let's say you're downloading a video file, and then you don't know that it's being uploaded. But then, if you're getting like some chunk of data,
yes, so you are uploading while downloading, that is absolutely true. But you need to have something that you have downloaded so you can start uploading at the same time. Right. So that is something you have to take care of. Okay, so we'll come back to all of this as we go along. Okay, so the last architecture I want to mention here is what is called self-managing system. So these are distributed systems that are adaptive in some shape or form. They have intelligence built in to autonomously make decisions without any human intervention. Okay. So these are broadly referred to as self-star system. They could be self-managing, which means they manage some configurations of the system themselves. Could be self-healing, which means the system can deal with failures and recover automatically by bringing other nodes online. So there are a variety of things that the system could do to manage itself. Yeah, typically in most distributed systems, many of these tasks would be done by an administrator or a human. Okay? If you build this intelligence into the system itself, you get what is referred to as a self-managing or an autonomous system, the autonomic system. Okay? The simplest example of this or simplest instantiation of this is to provision capacity to the server dynamically depending on the workload. Okay? So let's suppose you put up a website or your blog. Okay? You don't know a priori how popular it is going to be. Okay? So you don't know whether to put it on a large server with lot of capacity and lot of bandwidth to service a large number of requests, or to put it on a small server where only a few users access it and you have sufficient capacity to service a small user base. This is not known a priori. Okay? You can guess and pick one of these choices. Okay? If you guess wrong, then you will either pay for more resources than you need, or you will pay for a small server and then you have to turn away users because your server gets overloaded. Okay? So one way the system can deal with this problem automatically is to decide how much capacity your site needs on the fly by monitoring the workload that is coming into the system. Okay? So you start with a small server and you keep monitoring the workload, and as the workload grows, the system can dynamically or adaptively decide, saying it's time to move this website to a larger server, and you do this before you run out of bandwidth on the small server, and then your site migrates to a bigger system. And maybe the workload grows even more, then you can add more replicas to the system by adding more servers, not just a single server. So you could do these things automatically, or the system could do this automatically for you. So you are matching capacity to demand at all times. Okay, and as the workload goes down, you can scale back the capacity you have deployed into the system. So it's just one example of how a self-managing system would behave. So there are similar things you would do if you have a self-healing system, for instance. Okay, there were some questions. Your question.
So what would you do about like payment for this? If it's automatically increasing to bigger servers, you pay more? Or?
Yes, so the question is what happens to the payment? Clearly, you would have to pay more if you get more bandwidth and capacity. Yes, so you need to agree to pay for whatever capacity is used by your users. You could set upper limits and thresholds and whatnot. Right. So if you look at many web hosting if you look at Amazon's hosting model, which is basically a cloud computing model, it allows you to do this. You can set triggers that say if the utilization of the system rises above this, then add more capacity automatically. And you have to be willing to pay, of course. Then you have to turn this capability on. The system doesn't do it, but if you do it, then you pay for what you use. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, so what is basically shown in this picture is how such a system would work. It would monitor the workload, uses workload trends to predict what the current and future demand is going to look like. Okay, so if the workload is rising sharply and you predict that it's going to continue to rise for the next several hours, then you use those predictions and say, what is my current capacity? When do I run out of capacity if the workload rises at this rate? And then you adjust the allocation. Okay, and the same thing is if the workload goes down.
Does it always assume linear, or does it like do curves and figure out that the rate of change is increasing?
Right. So question is, how do you do this prediction? Is it linear or not? So these algorithms are fairly sophisticated. They use time series analysis. They can handle non-linearity, arbitrary growth. So a variety of techniques are used here. Okay, this is not one algorithm. There's a whole body of work that look at to see how you could go about predicting workload demand, how could you then adjust capacity and so on. Okay. Any questions on this?
The one that you discussed was adding another hardware manually. Like you have a system and you predict the demand using our software, and then based on the workload you add another resource. So would it be possible for you have all the resources and then dynamically turn it on as per the requirement?
That the latter is what the system would do. It is automatically adding resources to the pool. So it's assumed that you have a very large cluster. There's some servers that are not in use at any given time. That's called your free pool. Okay, those servers are basically either turned off or just idling, waiting for some demand. Okay, so as the workload increases, you would then take some server from the free pool and add it to a particular application. Okay, so there are multiple applications that are also assumed to share this large cluster. Okay, and the demand that each application is seeing is varying over time. Okay? So you basically take servers from the free pool, give it to these applications. When the application demand shrinks, you take servers back, add it to the free pool. So there is always some idle capacity that you can add on the fly to applications. Yeah, no human is involved here. This is all being done automatically. This is what humans would do, although not at this time scale. Okay, so typically what happens these days, if you don't have a self-managing system, is at some point your system gets overloaded, lots of requests start getting dropped, and somebody basically notes, some administrator notices this, that they're looking at the log or the utilization, said system is overloaded, and then they will manually bring a server online and add it and so on. So this is automating the whole process. Okay.
And you don't drop any clients this way, because it adds it before you need it.
Yes. So this, if you do this in a predictive fashion before you run out of capacity, then you will not turn away users. Okay, this is called a predictive approach. Okay. So that's chapter 2 of the book. So we have gone through 2 chapters, and now we are going to start dealing with the first major topic of the course. Okay, the first 2 chapters are basically overview chapters. So this is chapter 3, we are going to focus mostly on processes and threads. Okay. So our interest really is how do processes and threads, how can you schedule processes and threads in a distributed system. Okay. So what I am going to do today is provide you with sufficient background about processes and threads so that we can actually look at this topic of scheduling in more detail starting next time. If you do not have this background, then some of what I talk about in the context of scheduling may not make sense. Okay, so I'm going to start reviewing some material which some of you may already know. If so, bear with me. Okay, so the agenda for today is to really look at, or not today, but this is for the whole chapter, is to look at processes and their scheduling, multiprocessor scheduling, thread scheduling, and distributed scheduling, which is basically the problem of process and code migration in a large distributed system. Okay. So we'll start with processes. Okay. So this is review material. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about processes and then spend a little more time talking about threads, providing the necessary background. So you should all know what a process is. Okay. Process, the concept of a process allows you to implement what is called multi-programming. Okay, on any machine, you might have multiple processes that are executing concurrently. Okay, the OS basically switches between processes, okay, using a CPU scheduling algorithm. And this allows multiple programs to run concurrently on your system, okay, even if you have a single CPU. Okay, you have to contrast multi-programming with multi-processing. Okay, multi-processing basically says you have more than one CPU on the system and you also have multiple processes running. So more than one process can run in parallel. Okay, each scheduled process runs on a processor. Since you have more than one processor, multiple processes will run in parallel, okay, at the same time. Okay, in multi-programming, you have only one CPU, you are just switching between. So at any given time, there is only one process that is running. Okay, but you switch between them, so each process can make progress. Do you get the illusion that all of these applications are executing concurrently? In multiprocessing, applications or processes are actually running in parallel, one on each CPU or core. Okay. The data structure that any OS kernel uses to track all active processes in the system is referred to as the process control block, okay, or the PCB. PCB essentially stores all the information about a process that the OS needs to know. It includes everything from the owner of the process to where in memory is this process loaded, all of the page table information, the priority of the process, anything that the OS needs to know, all the files that are opened by the process, and so on. Okay. So each process has an address space in memory, and this is basically the region of memory where the process is currently loaded. Okay. Typically, you use some form of paging, okay, deal with memory allocation to processes. So physical RAM is partitioned into fixed size pages. Okay. Processes are also partitioned into pages, and pages are allocated to memory frames. Okay. The entire process need not be loaded in physical RAM. Okay. Only part of the process, which we refer to as a working set, need to be resident in RAM for the process to execute, and the rest of these pages are fetched on demand. Okay, as the process executes and it touches new pages, these pages could be brought from disk or swap space and loaded into RAM dynamically. Okay. This allows a process, the size of a process, to be larger than the size of RAM. Okay, because the entire process need not be loaded in RAM to execute, you can not only have multiple processes, but each process can be bigger than RAM itself. Okay, because only parts of the process that belong to the working set need to be loaded in RAM. Okay. The address space of a process consists of multiple segments. There is maybe a code segment which contains the code for the process. There are multiple data segments typically. There's a segment that stores global variables. There's a segment that stores local variables. The segment that stores local variables is called a stack. Okay, you probably know the concept of a stack. Okay. And there are other segments for shared memory and other resources that are open and so on. Okay. Okay, that's what the layout of a process in memory looks like. Okay, typically any process makes multiple transitions through its life cycle. Okay, starting from the time a process started executing to the time the process finishes execution. Okay, there's a very simple diagram that illustrates how a process executes, and as it goes from new to what is called ready, so this very simple state transition diagram shows the various states that a process can be in. Whenever you start a new application, okay, a process is started up and it is in the new state. Okay, in this state, the OS is actually loading the process and setting up the kernel data structures and whatnot. Okay, once it does that, then the process is ready for execution. Right? Being ready doesn't mean the process is running. It is merely waiting in a queue to be scheduled to be run on a processor. Okay, the CPU scheduler at some point in time will pick this process for execution, at which point it will start running on one or more cores of the system. Okay? If the process does any I/O or it uses its entire quantum of time that the scheduler has allocated to it, okay, it will go back to the, so if it blocks on I/O, it will go to the wait state. There's another transition here. Okay, if it merely uses up its quantum, okay, then it has to give up the CPU and go back to the ready state and wait for its turn again in order to execute. So it will cycle through all of these states and continue execution. So here you are doing I/O, here you are running on the CPU, here you are ready waiting to get the CPU to execute. Okay, so you will go through this and then you will eventually finish. Okay, that's this process state transition diagram. Now, I mentioned that there is a scheduler that is going to pick a process which is in the ready state for execution on a processor. Okay? And there are various algorithms that you can use to do this. Okay? And you pick the algorithm depending upon what is it that you want to optimize in the system. So there are many performance metrics that you could choose to optimize for your system. You could choose to optimize throughput, which is the rate at which jobs finish in your system. You could choose to optimize CPU utilization. This is what fraction of the CPU is current is in use on an average over some period of time. You could try to optimize turnaround time, response time, or fairness, or enforce fairness across processes. Okay? You cannot optimize all of these metrics simultaneously. And the reason for this is some CPU scheduling algorithms are optimal for some of these metrics, but this is at the cost of not optimizing some other metrics. Okay, so you might optimize response times, okay, which is for interactive jobs, but that may come at a cost of not optimizing throughput or vice versa. Okay, so you pick the right scheduling algorithm depending on what you want to optimize in the system. So what is listed here are some very simple uniprocessor scheduling algorithm. Okay, FIFO is just first come first serve. Okay, jobs just arrive, they are scheduled in first come first serve order. This may not even be preemptive, which means that jobs just run until completion. Okay, there is no notion of a quantum and whatnot. Typically what you may have is some variant of round robin, where you take jobs that have arrived and you give them a certain quantum of time on the CPU. Okay, and then if they use up their entire quantum or they block before the quantum expires, then they basically get evicted from the CPU and the next job gets to run. And then you cycle through all the jobs in a round robin fashion. Okay, cycle through all the ready jobs in a round robin fashion. Okay, shortest job first just says that you schedule the shortest job in the system next on the CPU. Okay, you can show that shortest job first is optimal for reducing waiting times. Okay, waiting time essentially is the time you wait in the ready queue waiting for the CPU. Okay, that's optimal for waiting time. But typically you will not see shortest job first implemented in any system. Okay, no system actually can implement SJF in its pure form. Okay, any thoughts on why?
How do they operate? Short jobs just keep coming in and you never get the long jobs.
Short jobs could keep coming, but never get to the long jobs. Yes, so there's starvation in shortest job first. Absolutely. That's a problem with the algorithm. You are saying something.
How do they obtain the length of the job? Like how long it
takes? Right. So there are two disadvantages or limitations of SJF, and those are the ones that I just mentioned. First is, you need to know the length of a job in order to figure out what is the shortest job. Okay. Typically, when you start an application, neither you nor the operating system really knows how much CPU this task is going to take. Okay. It may take some arbitrary amount of time. Okay. You cannot predict this, neither can the operating system. Okay. You may be able to make educated guesses, but they will be guesses. They may not be accurate estimates. Okay. So, since an OS doesn't know a priori how much time, CPU time, a job is going to take, it is not feasible to implement this algorithm, which fundamentally requires you to specify the length of a job when you start the job up. Okay, only in some special cases can you do this. So for any general purpose system, it's hard to implement shortest job first. Okay. Second problem that was mentioned is shortest job first has this problem of starvation. Okay. If you have a queue of jobs and some jobs are short and some jobs are long, you always favor the short job. Okay. And if there's a steady stream of short jobs coming into the system, these jobs would always get priority over a long job that's waiting. Okay. Because you always pick the shortest one. So we pick the first shortest one, and as soon as you execute, another one comes. Okay. And then this long job will starve forever. Okay. So starvation is not a desirable property in any operating system. You don't want your process to not make any progress whatsoever and just sit in a ready queue waiting for the CPU. Okay. So there are these two limitations of SJF, which is why you don't see it in any real system. Okay. And there are others here that I will not go into, lottery scheduling, earliest deadline first and so on. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about our process behavior. Okay. Typically any application or process goes through phases. Okay, you have typically two phases, a CPU phase or a computational phase where the application or the process is mostly doing computation, and an I/O phase where it most spends most of its time doing I/O. Okay, and processes will alternate between these phases. Some, you will do some computation, then you will spend some time doing I/O, and then based on the results of this I/O, you may do some more computation and I/O and so on. Okay, so you have the CPU I/O bursts that you will see. So you will do computation, then you will go into the I/O phase and the CPU phase. You will alternate between these two. Okay? And depending on the length of this computation phase and the length of the I/O phase, you can categorize any job as a CPU bound job or an I/O bound job. A CPU bound job spends most of its lifetime, not just within a phase, but most of its lifetime doing computation and very little time doing I/O. Okay? In contrast, an I/O bound task spends most of its lifetime doing I/O and very little computation. You still have these phases, but in a CPU bound job, the length of a CPU phase, a computation phase, is always significantly larger than the length of the I/O phase. And in an I/O bound job, it's the opposite. Okay, so typically, tasks could be CPU bound or I/O bound, and their behavior may change over time. You may spend, if you have long running tasks, may be CPU bound for the first hour and then you become I/O bound for the next hour and so on. Okay, so you may have these change in behavior. Okay, now regardless, this, because of this general notion of processes alternating between spending their time on the CPU and spending their time doing I/O, you can model their behavior using what is called a hyper exponential distribution. See, we don't need to go into a lot of detail here. This is just background that you just need to know. So what this distribution allows you to do is it basically allows you to specify the length of a CPU burst and a probability of seeing that burst. Okay, so this is what this distribution looks like. So basically, this is the length of a burst interval, a CPU burst. Okay, and that's the probability you will see. So you'll see that for any task, the longer the CPU burst, the less the probability of seeing such a burst. Okay? So there is some length of a CPU burst where the probability of seeing that burst is very high. Okay? So what this sees is, so let's call this the average CPU, average time spent in the CPU phase. Okay? So typically when you enter this the computational phase, the probability that you'll spend your time on the CPU for this period is high at a certain point, and the probability that you'll keep on doing computation without going to the I/O phase decreases exponentially as you go on. Okay, that's what a hyper-exponential distribution gives you. Okay, so this is the distribution that has been used to characterize the behavior of typical processes. Okay, we don't need to go into this in a lot of detail, but when you actually go and prove properties about scheduling algorithm, you need to characterize how your processes behave so that you can say, is this scheduling algorithm good for certain types of processes? And this is the distribution that's used to characterize process behavior. Okay, so let me talk about scheduling in a little more detail. Okay, I mentioned several of these uniprocessor scheduling algorithms, round robin, shortest job first, FIFO and whatnot. So let me talk about some more sophisticated variants of these that are actually used in most operating systems. And I'm going to talk about two, priority scheduling and a multi-level feedback queue and MLF queue scheduling. Okay. In priority scheduling, as the name suggests, okay, there are multiple queues, there are multiple ready queues. Okay. Each process is assigned a certain priority, and depending on its priority, it will join a certain ready queue. In other words, ready queues also have certain priority levels, and depending on the priority assigned to a process, it joins that ready queue. Within that ready queue, you do round robin scheduling, okay? And across queues, you use strict priority scheduling, okay? So what this means is whenever the scheduler needs to pick the next process for execution, it starts with the highest priority ready queue. Sees if there is a task waiting or a process waiting. If so, you schedule that for execution. Okay? And you continue to do this until that queue becomes empty. Okay? If that queue becomes empty, you go to the next highest priority queue. And then you see if there is a ready task there. And if so, you schedule it for execution. You do round robin and so on. So at any point in time, you will basically pick a ready task with the highest priority. Okay? That's at the head of its corresponding ready queue for execution. Okay. This is what priority queue does. Okay. If you look at Windows schedulers and many other schedulers, they use strict priority scheduling. Now, as you may as you can imagine, strict priority scheduling can cause starvation. Okay. If there's always a high priority task that is waiting to run, low priority tasks will not run in your system. Okay. This is why you need to use the scheduler very carefully. Okay. Typically, what is done or why you have priority scheduling is you take your tasks in the system and you partition them into two categories, kernel tasks and user level tasks. Kernel tasks are tasks that the OS kernel needs to run. Okay? User level tasks are all tasks that the all of your processes need to run. And in this case, it is always a good idea to give higher priority to kernel tasks or user level tasks so that the operating system can do what it needs to do to manage processes and hardware resources in the system. Okay? So the simplest priority scheduler is one where you take all your kernel tasks and you put them in a higher priority queue, and you take all the user level tasks and you put them in a lower priority queue. And this is okay. So the kernel, since it's a trusted application, is not going to cause starvation. It's written in a way where it is going to do its job and then get out of the way and let applications execute. Okay? Okay, so the next scheduler that we'll talk about is what is called a multi-level feedback queue. This is also a priority-based scheduler. Okay, but unlike the previous case, priorities are not strict in this case, as we will see. Okay, it's a small picture here that shows these multiple queues. Let me also draw this here. So let's assume single CPU system. This is priority level 1, 2, 4, and so on. So these are your ready queues, that's the CPU. So a multi-level feedback queue also has multiple queues, and it uses basically the same concept. Okay, it's basically going to look at the highest priority queue. Let's assume lower numbers mean higher priority. And then it schedules, if there's a task waiting, as one here, it'll schedule that for execution. We'll do this in a round-robin fashion until this queue empties and you'll go down and whatnot. Okay? But with one important difference between a static priority queue and MLF queue. In MLF queue, priorities are assigned dynamically to applications or processes. So what happens is whenever a new process comes into the system, it goes and joins the highest priority queue. Okay? So it gets to run on the CPU at some point. Okay? And then the way priorities are dynamically changed is the scheduler actually observes the behavior of this process. If the process ran for its entire quantum, that was assigned to it, it has dropped one level in priority. Okay, if this new process came and it used up the whole quantum and it was executing on the CPU, it will be asked, its priority will be lowered and it will join the lower priority. On the other hand, if the process relinquishes the CPU before the quantum ends because it blocked on an IO event, for instance, okay, then you have to give up the CPU immediately even if your quantum hasn't ended, then you will basically, your priority will increase by one. If you are already in the higher priority queue, highest priority queue, you cannot increase any further. But if you are job at priority 2 and you did not use up your quantum, you will rise. Okay, which means next time you will join this ready queue, not the lower one. Okay. Is this clear? So basically, what the scheduler is doing is it is treating CPU bound and IO bound tasks differently. Yeah, CPU bound tasks are tasks that are going to basically have a high probability of using their entire quantum, because they are mostly doing computation. They are going to use their quantum and be evicted from the CPU. IO bound tasks are ones that are very likely to give up the CPU before the quantum ends, because they do small bursts of computation and then spend most of their time doing IO.
Won't that cause starvation of CPU bound tasks, which if you're doing like a math application or something, you might want that to run and not be in lower priority?
So question is, what happens with respect to starvation? Let's try to understand the behavior and then we'll see if starvation will occur in this system. Okay. So what do we expect to see in terms of CPU bound tasks and IO bound tasks in such an algorithm? Where would CPU bound tasks be in these queues? Okay. So you will see that CPU bound tasks are likely to keep falling and be in the lowest queue. Okay, because every time they run, the probability that they will use up their entire quantum is high. So they will keep getting downgraded in priority and most of them will sink to the lowest queue. Okay. And you will see the opposite behavior for IO bound tasks. Okay, if there was an IO bound task in any of the lower queue, it will keep rising so long as it remains IO bound and be in the highest priority queue. Okay, that's one thing to keep in mind. So CPU bound tasks are given lowest priority typically dynamically and IO bound tasks highest priority. The one thing I didn't mention is that these queues not only have different priority, but they also have different quantum sizes associated with them. Okay. So just to give you an example, let's say any task that is in that's in this queue gets a 1 millisecond quantum and this one gets a 2 millisecond quantum and this one gets a 4 millisecond quantum and so on. Okay. So this quantum sizes as you go down are longer and longer, and then at higher priority queues they are short. Okay. So now you can see what has happened. So you run an IO bound task and it gets a fairly short quantum, which is probably what is the most desirable, because it is going to do a short burst of computation, go back to doing IO. No point giving it a long quantum, because anyway it's going to give up its CPU as fast as possible. Okay, and as in contrast, for CPU bound tasks, you want to give them longer quantum so that they make a lot of progress. Okay, but at a lower priority. You cannot do this at the expense of IO bound tasks. Okay. Now, there was a question of starvation. So the reason you are unlikely to see starvation in this system is that most of the IO bound tasks that are given high priority, okay, will take a short amount of CPU and go back to doing IO. So even if there are many jobs here, each of them will spend a relatively short amount of time and then become IO bound again. So the probability that this queue will empty quickly is high. Okay? And then you can go spend the rest of your time servicing CPU bound tasks. Okay, that's the basic rationale. Now you could of course have a scenario where there are lots and lots of IO bound tasks that keep getting ready and they just fill this queue up, okay, and never let a CPU bound task. Well, that is possible, but because of the dynamic behavior of most processes, that is unlikely. Okay? And to avoid starvation, there is also a safety rule in this algorithm. It says if you haven't run for a long period of time, then you also rise in priority. Okay, so if there are CPU bound tasks that are sitting at the bottom most queue, they're not running at all because there are lots of IO bound tasks, you keep rising until you hit the highest priority queue, at which point you'll get to run for at least a small quantum and then maybe you will fall down again. Okay, so you will make some progress, so it won't starve you completely. Right, so question is, will you not use round robin? You are indeed using round robin. That's true. but that doesn't let you avoid the problem of starvation. Round robin just says after your service, if you continue to be unable, then you'll go back to the end of the queue. Between levels is not round robin, it's priority based. Within a level, it's round robin. Right? So you will not do round robin across. You are only doing round robin within. So if there's always some active job here, you will never go and service this queue because you are doing strict priority.
For a single process, the CPU and IO may be interdependent, right? You might want the CPU first to be executed before a particular IO. But if the IO gets a priority, what would happen? Like, how is that made?
For a single process?
Yeah, say first the CPU has to be executed, then the IO, right?
Single process will do some computation, then it will block on some IO activity, in which case it won't be in any of these queues. These are ready queues. These are tasks that are asking for the CPU. There's also a wait queue here. These are all tasks that are blocked on IO. Okay? So if you are blocked on IO, you are taken out of this queue and you go into the wait queue and you wait there. Until your IO finishes, an interrupt comes, you service the interrupt, then you become runnable, then you join this ready queues. Okay, so there's no IO block, no task blocked on IO will be in these queues.
What happens in the case where a process needs to do both CPU and IO?
So a process needs to do.
Right, so
at any given time, you either are going to want to do computation or IO. You're not doing both if you have a single threaded process.
Okay.
Right?
So it does the CPU and it goes down.
Yes.
That much quantum, but next it needs to do an IO.
Right.
So,
so if
process is being
hit, right? Yeah. So this automatically handles changing in behavior. So if you are a CPU bound task where you want to suddenly start doing IO, then you become IO bound and you start rising in priority because after doing each of your IO, you rejoin this queue. You don't use your entire quantum because you want to go back to doing IO, so you keep rising.
So
that's exactly what you need to do.
How do you know whether it's a CPU or IO?
How do you know whether it's CPU? Yeah, so that's exactly what I said, right? If you use your entire quantum, then you are labeled CPU bound because you use the whole quantum and you are likely to use your entire quantum in the future.
Yeah. Right? But next execution you are using an IO.
Doesn't matter. Any behavior is fine. So if this is, so if you used up your quantum once, you drop, then you do an IO, so you don't use this quantum, so you rise. You continue to do IO, you will basically stay here. And as soon as you become CPU bound, you start using your quantums, you keep dropping. So depending on how your behavior changes, the scheduler also treats you differently.
Just continuing with this question, you said like if you continuously a CPU bound task to drop the priority, right?
Yeah.
But once at some certain level you block an IO, so you go back to the wait queue.
Yes.
So after the wait queue, how are you treated? I mean, because you were...
If you are in a wait queue, and the previous quantum that you executed, you did not use up your entire quantum, you will be put on the next higher priority queue. That's exactly what I said. Okay. Yes.
I have a question regarding like how do the processes drop and when do they go back to the queue? Like, because if a process in the first queue, if it's used up its quantum, it goes down a level, right?
Yes.
So when does it actually go to the back of the queue?
The only time you will go back is if you are in the highest or the lowest. If you are in the highest priority queue, you were scheduled, you did not use up your quantum, you cannot rise any further. You are already in the highest priority queue. Okay? And then you will go to the wait queue and then come back here. Okay? In this queue, what would happen is you would get a 4 millisecond quantum. If you use the whole quantum, you're supposed to drop in priority. You're already at the lowest priority, so there's nothing to do. So you'll just go and rejoin this queue. In any of the middle queues, you will never rejoin. You will either go up or down. Okay, so there's really, when you say round robin, it only means you're doing FCFS at that queue. Only at the top and the bottom, you're really doing round robin. Any other questions? Just one last.
Both these priority queues and multi-level feedback queue, is that a priority queue of priority queues or a priority queue of queues?
I didn't understand what you're asking.
No,
there's a more priority.
Is itself a queue or is that another priority queue?
In this case, this is just a queue.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yes. Yeah, so each of them is a queue, each of them is given a priority. These are not queue of queues, it's just single queue. Okay. The priority queue looks exactly like this, except that processes are static priority. Their priority is not changing. In a multi-level feedback queue, priority changes depending on your behavior. That's the only difference between the two. So their priorities are static, here they are dynamic.
So what happens to bits that are not
what happens to parent and child processes. Each
so parent is like executing simultaneously
to child process, but still has to wait. But both are I/O. No, so I mean, parent and child processes are just relationship between which process started and which process. As far as the CPU scheduler is concerned, it doesn't take this relationship into account. It is only looking at the behavior of an individual process. If your parent process is blocked on the child process, then you become I/O bound, or you go into the wait queue blocked. So you will be treated as if you are I/O bound. And if you are computing, then you will be treated as a CPU bound. These relationship across processes are not considered in making schedule.
That is in the queue. Then it will be again put back to the wait queue because the child is not executed.
If you are waiting blocked on the child, you will be put in the wait queue waiting for the child to execute, and when the child executes and does whatever it needs to do, you will get unblocked and you will go back to the ready queue. Okay. So with that scheduling background in mind, we'll come back to scheduling, but scheduling in multiprocessor system next step. Okay, this is all scheduling single CPU. In typical systems today, you have multiple CPUs, so we have to figure out how processes are assigned to cores or processors. Okay. But before we do that, let's look at the concept of a thread, okay, and how it differs from a process. Okay, what we'll refer to as a process or a traditional process basically is an address space with a single thread of control through that running through that address space. Okay, so you have a process or a program that's loaded in memory. Okay. So let's say there are functions or methods. Okay, this is typically binary, but so you are executing a certain point in the program. You are executing sequentially through functions, and when you make function calls, you basically jump to the function and then execute that function and whatnot. Okay? But there's one thread of control, and the thread of control basically says where in the program are you currently executing. Okay? That's what we'll call a process. Okay? In contrast, what we call a thread or a lightweight process is essentially a concept of an address space with multiple flows of control running through that address space concurrently. Okay. So in the same process, if you have a multi-threaded application, so if you have one thread of control which is currently executing this function foo, you may have another thread of control in the same address space that is executing some other part of the program concurrently with this thread. Okay, and you may have yet another thread which may be executing yet another function at the same time. Okay, each of this is an independent flow of control that is just running through the same address space. Okay, each of these flows of control is referred to as a thread. Okay, so you have basically think of it as if multiple parts of the programs are executing independently by an independent flow of control. Okay, each is going to execute the program sequentially, and as you make function calls you have loops and whatnot, you basically jump around, but otherwise your sequential execution within each thread of control. Okay. Now what has happened is the same address space is shared by all of these threads of control. Each has its own stack. Okay. Each thread will have its own stack. Just as a single threaded, what is a process is essentially what we'll call a single threaded process. It's only one flow of control. And what we call a threaded application is a process with multiple threads of control. And each will have its own stack, but they will all share global variables. Okay? So the stack of this thread basically says what are the local variables for this function, and then the pair function, the callee function, and so on. So as you return from function, then this part of the stack is popped, and as you make function calls, new variables are pushed onto the stack and so on. Okay, this works exactly like a traditional process. But each thread of control has its own independent stack. Okay? That's something to keep in mind. So you are basically getting potentially parallel execution of an application, okay, by multiple threads that are running through this application. Okay, is this clear? The basic concept of what a thread is. Now the thing to keep in mind is the address space is shared. Okay? So all the functions are known to all the threads. All global variables are visible to all of the threads. So if you are actually accessing global variables, you need synchronization to prevent bad things from happening. Okay? Because multiple threads could access the same global variable at the same time, One may be modifying it, another one is reading it. To ensure correctness, you want to use synchronization. You want to either use locks or semaphores to protect accesses to global data structures or global variables. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
If it's on one CPU, only one can read or write at the same time, right?
Yes.
So it's all one binary operation, all atomic.
Right. So there's a question saying if there's only one CPU, only one thread could actually be executing at any given time, okay, which is true. So why do you need synchronization?
Because one thread could read, hold the value, and write back later, I guess.
I guess it depends on the order in which they're run. So
depends on the order. The order depends on how the scheduler is scheduling threads, because each thread to the scheduler looks like a process. So this is basically thread 1 and this is thread 2, same process, then each of them gets to run. Right. So question is, do you need synchronization if you are on a uniprocessor system? So the thing to keep in mind is the scheduler is preemptive. Okay? Because you are given a fixed duration quantum, okay, you may be accessing a global data structure, but before you are done accessing it, your quantum may end. So you are not done accessing it, you are in the middle of accessing it, but your quantum has ended. So you have to give up the CPU. Okay? Some other thread could run next, and it could start modifying the same data structure. And when you come back and start executing again, the data structure that you started accessing, is it not in the same state as when you were evicted from the CPU? Okay? This is why you need to use synchronization even in uniprocessor system, because there is a scheduler that is preemptive. It is, if you had a non-preemptive scheduler, then you wouldn't need synchronization, because you could actually finish accessing your global data structure. Nobody else could run while you are running, because there is only one processor, and then you are fine. But because schedulers are preemptive, you are given a fixed duration quantum, and you may get evicted before your quantum ends and before you are done accessing this global variable, you need synchronization, because you do not want someone else to come and access these global variables while you are waiting for your next quantum. So if you hold a lock on this global variable, you would be, even though you are evicted, you are guaranteed, because you hold the lock and no one else holds it, you are guaranteed if some other thread runs and tries to access the same global data structure, it will block because it cannot get the lock.
Then won't it go up in the priority queue though?
It will go up in the priority queue.
No, run again and just block, and run again and just block.
No, if it is blocked, it is going to go into the wait queue. It's not ready to run, because you are waiting for the lock to become free. So you will be in the wait queue. Synchronization is same as doing I/O. Yes, what's the question?
So scheduler will know about locks then, basically.
Scheduler will have to know about locks. And if you're blocked on a lock, it's same as you're blocked on I/O. You have to wait for this event to occur, then lock is freed. Okay? So, point is, in the fact that your uniprocessor does not make synchronization sort of unnecessary. You still need it because you have preemptive schedulers. Okay. And clearly, if you have a multi-core system, then you definitely need synchronization, because multiple threads could be executing in parallel at the same time. Okay, so they will access any memory variable, they can access any memory variable in parallel, and then you will have bad things happening. Okay, so here's a picture of a thread that I just drew. So this is the address space of the process. Here you are shown three threads. Each has its own stack, which includes the program counter. The program counter says which instruction or where you are executing in this address space. And then you have your own set of registers. Okay? And then you also have your own stack. Okay? So, and this is different from the program counter of this thread, which is executing this part of the program. The registers refer to what is the state when this thread executes, and it has its own stack and so on. The global variables are shared. Okay, that's, you don't get your own copy. But you do get your own copy of local variables, your own copy of the register, and your own copy of the program counter. Okay, and as any of these threads is scheduled for execution, that thread makes progress. Okay, other threads have to wait, either in the ready queue or blocked on I/O, and then when some other thread gets scheduled for execution, this thread makes progress. Okay, yes.
This is basically what happens in the multiprocessor system, right?
No, this is what happens in a multi-threaded application. Doesn't matter whether you have one processor or multiple processors.
So we have a uniprocessor system, but how does the program counter change to every thread? Because thread is running, so it has to complete before the program thread is complete, right? So
right.
How can the program counter change?
So how can the program counter change? So what happens in a multi-threaded application is you are scheduling threads, individual threads, not processes. The CPU has to pick a thread for execution. So if it picks this thread for execution, this thread's program counter will start incrementing because it is executing this program. At some point, its quantum will end. So you will be treated exactly like if you are using MLFQ, you will either go back to the drop down or join the end of the queue, or if you blocked on an IO, you will block. Okay? And some other thread is then chosen for execution, that thread's program counter. So you are basically switching between threads just as you would switch between processes. Okay. So what you see in a individual, not a single threaded process is each has its own address space, and then there's the program counter and there's registers and there's a stack. Okay. This is another process. It has its own program counter. There are its registers and stack. The CPU chooses this process for execution, this process makes progress and its program counter increment. It chooses this process, this program counter increment. It's the same concept here except that this thread of control and this thread of control are sharing the same address space. That's the only difference between the two.
So, you're saying the time expires, the CPU state is altered?
Yes, the time expires.
For the thread, the entire CPU state is altered with a new set of program counter and
this. Okay. That's what happens in us, that's what the scheduler does. That's called a context switch. You swap out a thread or a process and you swap in a new thread or a process and the new one starts executing. Okay? Okay, so with that background, let's try to understand different types of threaded systems and why use threads. Okay. So I already mentioned some of this. So in large multiprocessors or multiple multi-core systems, okay, if you want to use all of the computational resources on your machine for a single application, then you need to have a multi-threaded version of your application. Otherwise, if you have a single-threaded process, it can only execute on one core or one CPU at a time. And these other CPUs cannot be used by this application. They may be used by some other process, but not by this one. Okay? So if you want this application to use all of the computational resources, you need a multi-threaded version. Okay? That's one reason to use threads. Okay? The other reason to use threads is rather than multiple processes, is that switching between processes incurs a high overhead. This is what happens during a context switch. Okay? If you either block on an IO event and relinquish the CPU, or if your quantum ends, then the scheduler has to do some work. Okay? And this work is you take the state of this process and you save it into the process control block. Take all the registers, they're saved in memory. You take the program counter, they're saved in this kernel data structure and whatnot, so that you can restore it when the process starts executing next. Okay. And then you pick a new process that is going to execute next and you take its state and you load it into the register. Okay. So this incurs some overheads. Okay. And this is called a context switch overhead. Now the claim is switching between threads incurs a much lower overhead than switching between processes. Question is why? Okay, so it shares the same address space. So what is that you do not have to do during a context switch between thread that you actually have to do when you switch across processes?
Global variables, process control block.
Process control block is smaller
than okay, what is not there in the process control block?
So you don't have to bring like memory from other sections of your main memory from your disk into your main memory because these processes may be like far apart.
Right. So swapping is there, but swapping is not part of the context switch. What you said is absolutely true, but that's not exactly why the context switch overhead is lower, but it's related to what you just said. So when you swap out a process, you not only have to swap out the program counter, the registers and the stack, you also have to save the page tables. Okay. This is basically the page tables tell you where in memory does this process reside. Okay. When you swap between threads of the process, the page table is not going to change because it's the same address space. So there is less information to save and restore in case of switching between threads. Okay. which is why context switches between threads is faster, because anything that relates to the address space need not be saved. So long as you're switching between threads of the same process, you're switching between threads of different processes, this is the same, that becomes identical to switching between processes. Okay, but if you're switching between threads of the same process, then there's less information to save and restore. Yes, question.
So will the scheduler give more priority to threads from the same process to run next? Because the scheduler, if it could obviously, even if you have multiple threads from the same process, it could say, oh, I'm giving this process.
Yeah. So there's a question of what should the scheduler do? Should it pick another thread of the same process because there's less work to do, or should it pick something else? This depends on the scheduler. In this multi-level feedback queue, you do not actually look at whether the thread belongs to the same process or not. You just use this. You think of each thread as an independent entity and you schedule. But there are schedulers that try to schedule threads of the same process, either one after another or parallel on the same multiple cores. Okay? We'll come back to all of this when you do multi-processor scheduling. Okay? So just as context switches between threads is cheaper than context switching between processes, so is creation and deletion of threads. Okay? Cheaper than creation and deletion of processes. Okay? The reason is the same. Creation of a thread just means that you need to allocate some extra memory to say the program counter, registers and stack in the kernel process control block. Okay? But the process is already loaded in memory. So long as this is not the first thread of the process, it's already there. There's nothing to load from disk. When you start a new process, you have to actually take the program and load the program in disk, some parts of the program, and you have to set up the kernel data structures at which point the process can begin execution. But starting a new thread within a process is much cheaper because the process is already set up. All you are doing is setting up some small data structures and you are ready to go. Deletion of threads is also cheap because you do not have to deallocate memory. Okay, or the address space of the process, those might be in use by other threads, active threads of the process. All you are doing is deleting this small part within the process control block. So it's significantly cheaper. Okay. So if you write your application in a multi-threaded fashion, okay, then lots of things become cheaper than if you use multiple processes to write your distributed application. Okay, you could write your application using threads and you will see some performance gains. Okay, so I think I mentioned some of this, but in a slightly different way. Okay, what we call a process is essentially in this more generalized system a single-threaded process. A traditional process gets mapped to single-threaded process. One address space, one thread of control. Okay, that's what a process looks like. Okay, and what we have now is a multi-threaded process where you have a single address space shared by multiple threads. So these are the two extremes. Okay. So a single-threaded process can make blocking system calls. Whenever it does some I/O, it blocks. There is no parallelism here. Okay? In a multi-threaded process, each thread can also make blocking calls. Each thread can block on I/O, but you get parallelism because although this thread may be blocked, other threads may still be active and ready to run. So the process as a whole can make progress even if some threads are blocked on I/O. Okay? In a single-threaded process, as soon as that process blocks, the process cannot make any progress until the I/O finishes. In a multi-threaded process, the application as a whole, okay, can continue to make progress because some threads can run while others are blocked. Okay? So that's the two extremes. So what you have in middle is a different model which does not use blocking calls for I/Os. Okay? It tries to get the advantage of a multi-threaded process without using the notion of multiple threads of control. So you have only one thread of control, exactly what you would have in a single-threaded process. Okay? But you can get parallelism by using non-blocking I/O calls. So you basically make a read call or a write call, or you get a try to acquire a lock or some other synchronization variable. And rather than blocking, you basically continue to execute, but you execute something else within the application. Okay? And then when this I/O event finishes, an interrupt is sent to you. Okay. And then you go back to this part of the program where you issued the I/O request and you resume execution. Okay. So this is called an event-based process model, okay, which uses non-blocking calls. Here you are blocking calls and this is basically a sequential execution model. Here execution is not sequential because you are jumping from one place to another trying to execute that part of the program where you can make some progress. Okay, and you never block because as soon as you issue an IO call, you basically say this part of the program cannot make any progress, so I'm going to execute something else. And the way this all works is through this notion of events. So events come and they trigger further execution, and then if there is any IO to be done, then you stop processing this event for any further, and then you go execute something else. Okay. So there are two ways to write any application, using blocking calls or using non-blocking calls. Okay. If you use blocking calls and use only a single threaded process, then you will basically not get any parallelism. So if you use blocking calls, the only way to get parallelism is through multi-threaded process. Okay? And on vice versa, if you have a single thread of control, then the only way to get parallelism is through use non-blocking calls. So if you use blocking calls, then you block and nothing else in your application can make progress. Okay? Is this clear what I've said here? So essentially what threads are given you is this idea of sequentially executing processes with blocking system calls, and yet you are able to achieve parallelism. This is the model that you are probably familiar with, that when you block to, when you issue a read to a file, the process waits until the results of that read comes back. Okay? So you get the same abstraction at the programming level, yet you are able to achieve parallelism. Okay? Writing event-based or non-blocking IO based application is significantly more complex. Okay? Debugging this application is also significantly more complex because execution is not sequential. If something goes wrong and you are basically you are previously at a certain instruction, you don't know what has happened because your application can suddenly start executing something else, some other instruction in the program. So debugging these applications is much harder. You get parallelism but also higher complexity. What you are getting here is, from a software engineering perspective, is parallelism with your familiar blocking call abstractions. Yes.
Could you do like asynchronous calls, so it doesn't block, it continues to the next, but it's all sequential, and when the data comes in, it just calls a function.
Right. Asynchronous calls are essentially what is called event-based, but it is not sequential because you may be executing something. You are not blocked when you issue a read. Continue execution, but when that read finishes, you jump somewhere else. So by definition, it's not sequential. Because when that interrupt comes, you have to stop doing what you're doing and go service that interrupt. So that's not sequential because you jump from here to somewhere else. That interrupts or events cause you to jump from one place to another. Okay, within, across events, you're doing sequential execution. Okay, so this is essentially saying the same thing. A block, non-blocking and asynchronous calls are synonymous.
It's kind of like spawning a thread that waits an IO and runs some code.
Right, exactly.
And that's what it does most of a lot of time.
Okay, is this clear? Alright, so let me give you some examples of applications that are written using multiple threads. Okay, so I'm going to go through this quickly. So I'll show you a client application and a server. Okay, web browser is a good example of multi-threaded application. So you have multiple threads within the browser that are doing different tasks. So let's say you type in a request, http://www.umass.edu. So there's one thread that basically goes and starts fetching this HTML page from the server. And suppose that the page comes back to you, then within this page there may be embedded images that haven't been downloaded from the server yet. So the browser could then start one thread for each of the embedded links and start fetching them in parallel. Okay? This improves the speed of downloading all of the content from remote server. So this main HTML page has, let's say, three images. Then you start three threads and you basically start downloading the three images in parallel. And as each image is downloaded, you can also render it in parallel on the screen. Okay? This is why any modern browser can download multiple embedded images or multiple embedded content and start rendering them in parallel. So you see that your pages are loading faster. Okay, if you did this sequentially, if you had only one thread in your browser, you would get the HTML page and you would look, parse the page. You look at the first image, then you get the image and then you render it. Then you go to the next image, then you go fetch that image and then you render it. So then you see that your page is loading much more slowly. okay, the top part of the page are loading and the bottom parts haven't loaded yet because you're sequentially going through the HTML page loading all of the content. Okay, you can speed this up using a multi-threaded browser.
Don't browsers also, while they're reading HTML and dump HTML, start actually loading it to the screen?
Yes. So you could also have threads that do rendering that are separate from the threads that do loading or downloading. That can also be done. You can have even more parallelism. So where you partition the functionality between rendering and downloading. So all of that can be done. So typically if you look at any modern browser, you will see 10 or 20 threads executing within it at any given time. Are doing all of these things. So that's an example of a client. Okay? You also can use multi-threaded servers. Okay? So remember that servers basically can receive concurrent requests from multiple clients at the same time. Okay? If you had a single-threaded server, then all of these incoming requests would come into a queue and you use, let's say, the first come, first serve. So you take the first request, you service it, send a response, take the second request, service it, send a response, and so on. Now this is going to increase the latency seen or the response time seen by clients. Okay, if there's only one thread. Okay. To speed up the processing of this request, most servers, okay, this includes web server, would be multi-threaded. Okay. So there's what is called a dispatcher thread and there are worker threads. Okay, there are large number of worker threads and there is a dispatcher thread. Okay. Whenever a new request comes in, it joins a queue. And then this dispatcher thread will basically look at this request and say which thread, which of the worker thread should take responsibility for processing this request. If there's an idle worker thread, then you can give this request to that thread. If there are none, you could dynamically start a new thread and say service this request. Okay? So if there are multiple requests, concurrent requests coming into the system, then each of this as the dispatcher has taken this request, given it to this worker thread, the next one is here and so on. And each thread is executing concurrently and servicing this request. And if you have multi-processor system, you will execute in parallel and request will finish faster. Okay? Once a request is done, then this worker thread becomes idle. Okay? And then a dispatcher thread can take a new request and give it to that worker thread. Okay? So this is how you can write a multi-threaded server that can concurrently serve multiple requests.
What would you spawn one new thread per user?
Okay. Why would you not spawn a new thread per user?
Why do you have a pool of workers? Why don't you just always spawn a new thread? Right.
So that I was going to come to this issue next, saying there are two types of models in a multi-threaded server. One is called a thread per request model. In a thread per request model, whenever a new request comes in, a new thread is started. It services this request and this request only, and once it's done, this thread is terminated. Okay, so each request is serviced by a new thread that is started dynamically whenever this thread arrives. Okay, this is one model. Another model, so in this case, each worker thread, the lifetime of a worker thread is the time it takes to service an individual request. In another model, you have a static pool of threads that are pre-spawned when the server starts up. And the dispatcher thread is basically just assigning requests to worker threads. Okay. And once the worker thread is done executing the request, it goes back to an idle state waiting for the dispatcher to send new work. Okay. So this is basically a static pool model. Now there are advantages of either. Okay. In the static pool model, you do not have the overhead of creating and deleting threads. There is some overhead. If you have a very heavily loaded system, this overhead starts mattering. Okay. So the throughput of your system will be somewhat lower in a thread per request model than if you had a static pool. Okay. So that's the advantage of a static pool. You don't pay the price of creating a thread, starting a new thread every time a request comes in. So throughput will be higher. The disadvantage of the static pool basically is that if you guessed wrong on how many concurrent requests you are going to receive, then some requests are going to be queued up. If you had only 10 worker threads, you can service 10 requests in parallel. If 15 requests came more or less at the same time, 5 would have to wait until the first 5 finish. Okay, so the latency will be higher. In a thread per request model, as requests come in, you start in parallel. So if 15 came, 15 threads would be started up.
In Java, there's a dynamic thread pool class already there. You could say that if too many requests are coming, you can actually expand the pool.
Right. So most sophisticated browsers would not use really a static pool, but the size of the pool would vary dynamically depending on the load. Okay, if you see that the queue of requests is growing and the pool of worker thread is small, then you would dynamically start new one. And vice versa, if there are lots of idling worker threads and no work in the queue, then you will terminate some. So the size of the worker pool can also be adjusted dynamically in any modern server. Yeah, but there will be some time it takes for the server to realize that the queue is building and start new threads. Okay, in that time the request would have to wait. So for a short period of time the latency goes up, then more worker threads are started, then get more concurrency and vice versa. Okay. So this is how any sophisticated server, multi-threaded server would behave. So we'll come back to more on both multi-threaded browsers, servers, as we look at more aspects of distributed system, but this was just a quick example. Okay. So let me just mention this and then I will stop here. So I talked about the notion of a thread, I talked about some examples of where threads are used, and there's something to keep in mind that there are two types of threads that you typically see in practice, what are called kernel level threads and user level threads. Okay. And the difference between kernel level threads and the user level threads is one where is the operating system aware of the presence of threads within a process or not. Okay. In a kernel level thread, every thread within an address space is visible to the operating system. Okay. So it can schedule threads independently. In the user level thread model, the OS kernel can only see a process. It cannot see what is inside the process. And the threads within that process are actually managed by user level library. Okay? So the threads are only visible to the library, not to the OS. Okay? So what would happen in a user level thread is the OS would schedule the process. Okay? And then this library, the scheduler in the library would run and it would pick one of the user level threads. So there's two levels of scheduling. There's a kernel level scheduler that picks processes and the user level thread scheduler picks individual threads. Okay. In the kernel level thread scheduler, the kernel automatically picks not only the process but which thread within the process should execute next. Okay. That's the main difference. We'll see more about these two next time. And there was a question here. Yes.
Yeah, pthreads,
which kind is that? So pthreads, question about pthreads. Pthreads is basically POSIX threads. It is an interface. It says this is the API you use to create and delete thread. The pthread spec does not specify whether you should use kernel level or user level thread. That is left to the implementation. You can get user level library implementations of pthreads. You get pthread implementations that are integrated into the kernel. By default, if you are using pthreads, it is more likely you use kernel level threads. Okay? Unless you have actually downloaded a library that implements pthreads. Okay? But you get both types of implementation. Because it doesn't specify what to use. Yes, last question.
If you're using user-level threads and one of the threads blocks an I/O, then the whole process, all the threads, stops because it doesn't realize that multiple threads are running in user-level.
Yes. So there are some disadvantages of not being visible to the OS. So if a user-level thread blocks, the whole process blocks. That's what we'll. Yes. That's what we'll talk about in the remaining slides, which we have sort of run over time. So let's stop here. But we'll come back to this issue next time.